week of March 29th, 2020, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 487, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Beverly Hills, California, with an armband, a black armband, in front of Nate Nowles, I'm Michael Giltz.
We're so close, we should just record the show together this week.
6 feet apart, Sperling.
All right, fine. So stay at Nate Nowles. Listen, here's I'd like you to give you my order, though.
Yeah, no takeout. No delivery. Nowles is closed for good. The Beverly Hills institution has been struggling for a few years now. They blame the actual final shutting of the company on the coronavirus. But in fact, for years, people have been reporting that they've had trouble paying their lease. And me, I blame Mike Ovitz and CAA.
Well, okay. Mike Ovitz, I don't know that you could blame him, because Creative Artists Agency, which Mike Ovitz ran for 20 some odd years, he moved the company to the heart of Beverly Hills, and you could walk to Nate Nowles from the CAA offices on the corner of Wilshire and Santa Monica in that beautiful IM Pay building. But then recently, maybe about 5 years ago, they moved to Century City along with ICM, another big talent agency.
Were they the first to move, or...
I can't remember whether it was ICM.
5 years ago. So they all moved in the last 5 years?
They all moved en masse. It used to be that if you were an agency, you had to be in Beverly Hills. You had to have that Beverly Hills address. It was kind of a cachet thing. Then it didn't really matter. As more agencies, more talent agencies became corporatized, they wanted to be in a corporate setting, which is Century City, just a few miles away. Ugh. And then slowly, like APA, Agency for the Performing Arts, and Paradigm have slowly started to move back into Beverly Hills, but it was far too late. All those lunchtime deals that took place at Nate Nowles, it was too late. I mean, I would go there. I had a job interview there once with the Paradigm Talent Agency.
How did it go?
Yeah, it didn't go well. I actually spilled orange juice over the person that was interviewing me, and I did not get that job.
Now, are you sure you were interviewing, or were you perhaps just waitering?
I was wearing a suit and tie, so okay. I hope it was an interview. And you know who didn't wear a suit and tie there was Rupert Murdoch, who just a few years ago, I was there eating lunch, and Rupert Murdoch comes in, he sits down literally right next to me. I could have poked him in the ear.
Well, don't do that, but it is sad. It's an institution for sure. If you got rid of all the deals that happened in Nate Nowles, there'd be no Hollywood. And the equivalent for me, I think, is when Tower Records shut down in New York. It sort of took out the heart and soul of a neighborhood for me. It's a punch in the gut. There's nothing can replace it. And certainly there are almost no record stores left. There are a few used record stores, but nothing like there used to be with Tower Records and a few others. In Beverly Hills, I'm sure there are still delis, but nothing like Nate Nowles, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely nothing like Nate Nowles. And I used to live down the street from Tower Records on West 4th Street.
Oh, very nice. Oh, in Manhattan.
In Manhattan.
Oh, you live down there. That's a great street.
Yeah, I know.
You probably went to that gay bar, right? Oh, never mind. No, perhaps.
I went to NYU, which is located right there, and so I lived in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a neighborhood I've spent a ton of time with. I never lived there, but I know it well. So that's very sad about Nate Nowles. We're at episode 487. I'm wondering if episode 500, will we still be in lockdown? Good Lord, I hope not. But while we're here, we're doing shows. What are we going to talk about this week?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we remain in self-isolation. It's where we've been pretty much all our lives, actually. So at least now, there's a name for it, okay? I had no idea there was a name for this. In China, a few cinemas opened up, and then they shut right back down again. We'll take a brief dive through the latest news on the coronavirus and COVID-19 crisis. In the last 2 weeks, we've been looking at the entertainment industry and the pandemic by taking a step back. What are the long-term effects of this, and how will everyone bounce back? First, we spoke with Andrew Wallenstein, the co-editor-in-chief of Variety. And then last week, we spoke with Paul DeGarabedian, a senior media analyst at Comscore, and we talked about movies. This week, we're joined by Evans Hale, the executive director of the York Theatre Company, which is celebrating its 50th season in New York City. And by the way, that's just one of his many jobs, okay? Evans knows everyone in theater, from Broadway producers to regional powerhouses, and he's going to share with us the challenge each of them faced during this time. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll discuss just a few of the week's top headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's lack of box office. You know, we keep changing that line and it's tripping me up.
When we get back to box office, we're going to set off fireworks when that happens. That'll be exciting news. So we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore. Well, actually, we don't have a link to ComScore because there's nothing on the ComScore website. But we can look to Box Office Mojo and Box Office Mojo, Box Office Profit, nothing there.
I thought it was crazy when we were linking to the Chinese box office.
And that there was zero.
I thought, oh my gosh, that's crazy. That's insane. And now it's even more insane.
The Chinese charts, blank. The India charts, blank. For the first time in history, there is no national box office in any of the major markets around the world. However, Deadline came through for us again. They have a report on the handful of screens still open in North America. Good for them. They're mostly drive-ins, though some of them have shut down due to local ordinances. The number one movie in North America is Pixar's Onward. That grossed $52,000 at 19 theaters last week. I'd love to go. We had a drive-in in my neighborhood, in my town. It shut down just a few months ago, unfortunately, for good. I would have had it on out there. It'd be a great time to see a double bill. At number two in North America is The Hunt. That made $40,000. Bloodshot earned another $40,000. That's just a tick below The Hunt, apparently, maybe by a few dollars, I guess. Sonic the Hedgehog grossed $38,000. The Invisible Man grossed $37,900. The Van Buren Drive-In in Riverside, California continues to survive. I mean, you know, this is what we're reduced to. The Mission Tiki in Montclair, California. So that's really what we're looking at when we look around the world at the box office. Just a handful of hearty souls still keeping the lights on in a way that's safe and easy. But when you look at the ComScore charts, you can find some numbers still coming in from last week. You know, some countries are still filling in the blanks. We're still getting in some numbers for the box office from 2 weeks ago. Our in-house spiritual advisor, Reverend Andy, called in. He said they had a sale of 5 tickets to Frozen 2 and 2 tickets to a movie called The Mechanical Man, which I have not heard of. Of course, what he's really reporting are not ticket sales, but premium video on demand. His family sat down and watched Frozen 2, five people all together, and then two of them watched another movie on demand called The Mechanical Man. So we don't have box office figures that are very steady, except for what Deadline reported, but we do have the numbers, or rather the rankings, for the most popular premium video on demand movies. This comes from ComScore. They're about a week behind where we would be for box office. If we were reporting on box office, we'd be covering the last week up to March 29th. For the premium video on demand market, this is North America only, not worldwide. And we're reporting what was most popular 2 weeks ago, the week of March 16th to 22nd, just when the coronavirus was starting to take off, or at least our awareness in North America. So the number one movie in North America in premium video on demand is Jumanji, The Next Level, a big family-friendly movie. Right below that is Knives Out, adults catching up with that very popular Agatha Christie-like hit. And number three is Bombshell, a movie taking Fox News to task. And right before that, Clint Eastwood takes the rest of the media to task with Richard Jewell. That's a movie that could use every penny it makes in premium video on demand because it was not a hit at the worldwide box office.
Premium video on demand? Well, it's transactional. They're transactional video on demand.
Okay, tell me the difference.
Well, premium video on demand is during a window when the film is still in theaters it hasn't reached
its
VOD.
Price point.
A different price point.
It's just it's video on demand at a higher price. That's all
correct.
It is. And at a different point. So it's really all video on demand.
Right. Well, and as a matter of fact, Netflix is considered video on demand. It's called SVOD, and the S is for subscription.
Or I thought that was streaming. Well, they're all streaming, I guess.
Yes.
Right. But when you talk about video on demand, we're talking about people paying money to rent a movie and or buy it, I assume.
No. Actually, video on demand is not electronic sell-through.
Okay. So look at the ComScore charts and tell me how they tag it and whether we're doing this right, whether we're describing the content that they're doing right here. I'm assuming we are because this chart includes Frozen 2. So they're putting together all video on demand rentals, I assume.
Yes, that is correct.
So whether you rent it for $4 or $40, they're going to include it on this chart. I should not have called it premium, but basically we're just including all digital movie rentals. You know, you're not going to Netflix and streaming a movie. You're paying to rent a movie for 48 hours typically and get to watch it. We don't care whether you're paying $25 or $40 because it's the movie still in the theaters or coming early, or whether you're paying $4. These are the most popular movies that people can rent via video on demand. Normally in the old days, you would be on your cable channel scrolling down through a list of bunch of movies. Now, of course, you get them through services and stuff like that. I assume,
and for the most part, actually, a lot of the stuff we're getting is through cable companies. So
it's still happening that way.
It is still happening that way. And of course, yes, Amazon Prime, iTunes, they let you rent
movies too. Netflix, of course, you don't do that, but pretty much everyone else you can.
Correct.
Okay.
And what I think is funny is that nobody is telling you exactly how much money the movie made.
And why is that?
Because if you're a studio,
they don't like to share.
Yeah, you're saying, "Oh man, we're just so broke, man. Your film did so bad on VOD. Yeah, you're number one, but that's only because two people rented it, not just one."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't like to talk about how much money they make in the aftermarkets. TV networks and, or I should say, TV producers, studios making TV shows, talk very little about the windfall of money they get from international sales. They really don't talk about that. Studios never liked to talk about what money they were grossing on DVD and Blu-ray, both rental and sell-through. Same thing before that with video cassettes. They just liked to keep that little secret to themselves because at one point, they were making more money from renting and selling movies on DVD and Blu-ray than they were making at the box office. And that made them know they didn't want stars to cotton to that. But they are. So we're looking at video on demand. Jumanji's number one, Knives Out, Bombshell, Richard Jewell. And at number five is Spies in Disguise, the Will Smith animated film. At number six, one that's not for the kiddies, is Uncut Gems, the Adam Sandler movie. Big hit at the box office given its budget and doing well on video on demand. I'm going to skip number seven. And number eight is Frozen 2. And number nine is Ford versus Ferrari, a very good movie. I recommend it highly. And number 10 is Dark Waters. At number seven is the only movie that's not a recent release. And hey, people, when you're looking at movies to rent or watch, don't just pick the most recent movie. You know, they always do this. Oh, yeah, I saw that advertised Bombshell. This is what, like, watch a great classic film. If you want to watch a recent film, great. Then follow it up with a classic movie you've never seen before. Spice it up, people. There's a lot of great movies you've never seen. And that brings us to number seven, the only movie that's not a current release. It came out in 2011, and it's Steven Soderbergh's Contagion.
Yes. Now, this is a film that is it tracks very closely to what is going on now. It's a pandemic, kind of on steroids. You know, it's basically incredibly deadly and incredibly transmissible. So it just wipes out entire populations. But it tracks with science. So you know, I guess
it's not a sci-fi movie. It's a movie.
No. Very realistic.
It cost about $60 million to make. It only grossed $135 million worldwide. I think it probably had a very strong afterlife because it's a big starry cast. Matt Damon, Lawrence Fishburne, Jude Law, Gwyneth Paltrow, Kate Winslet, you name it. Lots of great talent in the movie. It's Steven Soderbergh. I'm sure it was well promoted on DVD and Blu-ray and then rentals and streaming and all that stuff. And here they are now making more money. So movies that aren't necessarily hits at the box office straight off the bat, we can often say, yeah, you know what? They're not losing money on this puppy. That's for darn sure.
No, and as a matter of fact, what you can say is the following. Yeah, okay. You didn't make $400 million off of that one title theatrically. However, you made, let's say you made $60 million. You actually took in $60 million in theatrical receipts that you
so,
as the
so
distributor
So that covers
got.
Your budget. For,
there you
but
go.
not your prints and advertising, but then everything else brings you over to that.
Correct.
All right. Well, that carries that's the chart from ComScore covering video on demand. But let's get an update on the coronavirus update. Some of the news that we've got. There's so much, and basically the general message is nothing's happening. But some things
not even the Olympics. Not even the Olympics. They were delayed exactly 1 year. It looks like they're going to be, you know, the opening ceremony will now be held in Tokyo, Japan, July 23rd, 2021.
That's right. And the Tony Awards have been postponed, of course. And there's more layoffs and furloughs and firings. Paradigm apparently cut a third of its staff. That's more than the sixth of the staff that we understood before. They have cut 250 out of their 750 strong staff. Endeavor also fired 250 people, but they've got 7,500 people, about 10 times as many as at Paradigm. So that's not quite the same thing. As we say, movie theaters are being hurt hard. AMC has basically furloughed everyone at their headquarters, the entire 600 plus staff, including the CEO.
Well, now, those are two companies, William Morris Endeavor and AMC, that are heavily leveraged. AMC did $2 billion deals a couple of years back. They bought Carmike Cinemas in the US. They bought Odeon and the Nordic Cinema Group in the EU. And they have to service that debt. Well, with no money coming in, they can't service that debt. And Endeavor, likewise, they did $1 billion deals to purchase IMG and that boxing. Why am I blanking on the name of this mixed martial arts? Mm-hmm. League, and they are heavily leveraged with talent agencies. The big problem is personal appearance fees. 50% of what William Morris Endeavor makes comes from booking live events.
Do you mean just music concerts, or are you also talking like lecture circuits and things like that?
Yeah, less so the lecture circuits. It's mostly music.
Okay.
Like the music departments are making a lot of money.
Well, and that's the only place artists are making their money. They're getting dimes on the dollar in terms of album sales and streaming and all that stuff. So the live music world is all the more important for them. And now, of course, that's not happening at all. It will happen eventually in a few months. Hopefully they'll get back to live music. But big events, like big sporting events and big concerts with a bunch of people crammed in together, that's the last thing that's going to start happening, right? You can have social distancing at a restaurant and have every other table. You can do other things like that. A movie theater, you could sell half the seats. But big concerts where everybody's standing next to each other, that is going to be the final thing that comes back on board. So they have the longest way to wait.
Yes, that is very true. And, you know, when you're an agency and you've got the people at the top, you know, the big agents and even the mid-tier agents, and then you've got support staff like human resources and accounting and things like that. And then you've got assistants. And those assistants are usually agents in training. But right now, what would they be doing by working from home?
Well, nobody has worked. We understand why they were fired and laid off, but that doesn't make it any easier. But AMC, Endeavor, of course, was just hoping to get to that big initial public offering so they could cash out and let the risk be shared by a bunch of other people. But AMC, I don't know how to say sugar daddy in Cantonese or Mandarin, but don't they have Wanda backing them up?
Well, they do. Wanda Dalian is the company out of China, which is not really allowed to send money out of the country anymore. They own about 51%. They sold some of their stake. Wanda sold, I think, 10% of their stake, and now they own 51%. But a lot of Chinese companies are not allowed to invest money outside of China, especially
They've already done that, and so they have deep pockets backing them up. So they're not on their own.
They're not on their own, but they're kind of on their own because Wanda is not sending money their way. In fact, Wanda has been in a bit of dire straits themselves. They've been selling properties.
Right. I think the financial stuff is a little more deeper than that. They don't want the Chinese government clamp down on companies investing more money overseas, but they own AMC. So that's already investment they own. They don't want it to collapse because that would be a Chinese company that would be suffering. So I think it's a different issue there. But you're right. Things are tough for everyone. And in fact, we thought we had some good news coming from China. They, of course, are farther along in dealing with the coronavirus, perhaps flattening the curve and getting to the other side. And they had opened up some cinemas, about 500, 600 screens opened up, like 5% of the cinemas in China, mostly in second and third tier markets, meaning not the major cities, but in smaller towns, were opening back up again and showing some recent big hits to say, hey, remember the fun of going to the movies. That lasted about a week or 5 days. And then they said, nope, shut it back down again.
Right. And that's, I guess that's the China Film Group getting ahead of what the government actually wanted.
Well, so, I'm sure they didn't do it without government approval. Nothing happens there. So it's not that they did something. The government said, hey, you can't do that. The government just suddenly had second thoughts and said, you know, because it doesn't happen unless the government approves. So
you'd be shocked.
Mm-hmm. No, it was national news, worldwide news that their cinemas were opening up. The Chinese government was proud to put out the PR that they were moving beyond this and starting to get life back to the normal. But then they just realized, oh, some new cases started to flare up. And they said, we got ahead of ourselves. We screwed up. So they are not happy about the fact that they had to shut them back down. And they were thrilled that they were opening them back up again, even tentatively, because that made them look like they'd been smart. They'd been good. They'd gotten to the other side. And that isn't the story yet. So that seemed to be good news, but it's not. Here's some actual good news short term. Powell's Books in Portland, Oregon. I've never been there, but I have friends who've been there, like my friend Joe from the Iris.
And it's an amazing place.
I can imagine. I would get lost for days. It's like the Strand, I guess. You could just spend days wandering the aisles. And they fired a bunch of people or furloughed them. I don't know the technical term for what they did, but they were in crunch time, of course, like everybody else. But then online orders started pouring in. They have rehired 100 staffers to help fill those orders. So we're glad those people are back to work. But this is online orders, and I can't help thinking when we get to the other side of this virus, all these tiny little indie bookstores that people said, isn't that wonderful? Our little community bookstore opened up again. They don't have a penny to their name, and they can't go 4 months without paying rent, and they can't afford to take out a loan and try and pay it back because they're never going to make up that 4 months of lost income. So I think we're going to lose some independent bookstores again, and the big are just going to get bigger. I love Powell Books. They're in spirit an independent company and in practice, but you're going to see Amazon and Powell and The Strand and a few others benefit from people switching to more and more online ordering. Fewer independent bookstores will actually be physically present in towns and cities around the country. It's a big loss for everyone.
Yeah, I think the same is true of movie theaters. I think you're going to see a lot of movie theaters, like independent movie theaters, struggle to reopen.
Right. I mean, I always forget until I learned from you, you know, half of the theaters in this country are big chains like AMC and Regal and Landmark and people like that. Even the big, you know, art houses are often chains of relative size and merit. But half of the movie theaters in this country are mid-size, small chains, and mom and pops, and they do not have the deep pockets of those big guys. And they're in markets where the big guys probably just don't want to go because it's not big enough to support what they do, which is open a 10 or 20 screen multiplex. There's just not enough people there, so they're never going to go there. So if these little mom and pops places close down, nothing is going to replace them.
And that's actually very true. I don't want to get into, you know, the nitty gritty of it. That would actually would probably be a good inside baseball about, you know, leasing and rent.
Well, have you guys done a story on this? Have you thought about at Celluloid Junkie about looking at these chains, and if they disappear, there's no one that can probably step in to replace them for lots of complicated reasons. If you guys have done a story or have an expert that we can talk to, let's get them on the show.
Yeah, well, that's actually one of the stories we are trying to work on. Of course, nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody wants to go on the record to say, yeah, we're about to, you know, collapse.
Well, I don't know why not. I mean, just being realistic about the challenges that you face is not a sign of weakness, you know?
Yeah, well, especially since everybody's facing them at the same time.
Right, and it's not a surprise if you're a mom and pop record store. Life is a struggle. You know, life is a struggle for every small little company. It's also a struggle for small theater companies. Big Broadway shows are closing down, but you know, they may not happen. The big producers will move on to the next project. But these tiny little theater companies in New York City and around the country, they're always struggling to pay the rent. They're always struggling to keep the lights on. And they do it because they love theater. So we're looking at the industry step by step. Last few weeks, we looked at the movie industry. Now we're going to look at the theater industry. And of course, put it in context. We know nothing matters as much as people's health. That comes first. And in every industry, the people hurt most are going to be the employees, the little guys, on men and women on the front lines who are always struggling to pay their bills and never paid what they're worth. So we recognize that. But nonetheless, we think it's useful to look at the challenges being faced in all these different sectors like music and TV and publishing and so on. So if you're an expert or you got a business in that area and you'd love to offer your expertise, reach out to us. We'd love to hear from you. Where can they talk to us, Sperling?
Well, they can reach out to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The voicemail number, our phone number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're at showbizsandbox is our handle, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
That was the slowest rendition of that you've done in ages.
I've been told I speak too fast.
You can find all the links on our website, right? Showbizsandbox.com.
Yes, correct.
So no excuses, people. No excuses. And write and review us, for the love of God. You've got nothing to do. You're trapped in your home. Would it kill you to click 5 stars on iTunes? Come on, people. Anyway, we're going to talk about theater. The show must go on. And tell us about the guest. It's a friend of mine.
Well, today we're joined by Evans Hale. Evans Hale has decades of experience as a producer, artistic director, and performer. Evans is the executive director of the York Theater Company, which is celebrating its 50th season in New York City. He's also the executive director of Opera North in New Hampshire and the producing director of the Gainesville Orchestra. This guy, you know, people are losing their jobs. Evans has more jobs than he...
Give me one.
Yeah. Well, prior to all of that, Evans spent 15 years helming the Cape Playhouse, America's oldest professional summer theater. Produced shows at Lincoln Center, the historic town hall, and off-Broadway, and oversaw the restoration and recording of classic musicals like Cole Porter's 50 Million Frenchmen and Villa-Lobos' Magdalena. He was producer and host of NPR's Toast of the Town radio series and has toured the U.S. and the world as a performer and conductor with major orchestras and opera companies. Evans, thank you for joining us.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here and so appreciative of you all keeping the fire flamed out there.
That somehow we are. But I should make clear that Evans and I are friends. We've known each other for many years. I struggle to figure out how to describe what you do. I guess impresario is the best word. You do so many different things, and it's pretty exciting. I'd like to say I'm your friend, but I feel like I'm more an acquaintance because you're always jetting off around the world doing something exciting, so I don't get to see you that much.
Well, we are definitely friends, and we do share a long history going back many years here in Gainesville, Florida, as well as in New York. So isn't it great that we are able to stay that connected?
Absolutely. So the first thing, we are going to look at theater today, and I think you have a unique perspective because you have ties to everyone from big Broadway people, stars, and probably producers and stuff. You know regional theaters, you know cabaret people, right down to the kids who just come off the bus who are ready to study their craft and dream of getting that big break. So we're going to sort of work our way down through the ecosystem of theater. Everybody's facing the same problem, money, as they always do. It's always how you're going to pay the bills. That's a perennial problem for anybody who's creating a company, unless you're, you know, Lincoln Center. You're always struggling and you're always living on the margins. So this is going to really hit hard. There's no doubt we're going to lose regional theater companies. We're going to lose talent. We're certainly going to lose shows that will never happen.
Right.
So it's kind of heartbreaking. But you talk to a lot of people. Before we get to York, just in general, how are people doing? Are they freaking out? Are they just singing songs on YouTube and making do that way? What's going on?
Well, I think it's all of the above. I mean, there is a reality that obviously, as you've said, the financial hit that the arts are taking across the board is enormous in capital letters. But at the same time, I think there is a realization, or I certainly hope there's a realization, as many people are quarantined or having to stay at home, that what are they doing? Well, they're turning to YouTube, they're turning to books, they're turning to movies, they're turning to live performance online. And I think that one of the great things that we as participants and producers in the live arts do is that we know how to create things under the worst of circumstances, because frankly, many of these companies always have had to do that. And by adapting to the current technology that we have in front of us, we are doing the same thing. And as you said, you know, I mean, the other day, Billy Stritch, the amazing pianist and singer, has been teaming with Linda Lavin to do weekly live concerts from Facebook.
Her new album just came out, by the way, available on Spotify and all of the streaming services.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That theater companies are able to stream or even create productions that were almost ready to open, but were not able to open. They've come to agreements with the unions so that they can actually do a live stream of a performance, that would normally have been seen by their folks, by their audiences, but now are seen streamed online. I think that there is a, as I said, coming out of this horrible period of time that we're going through, I hope that there will be a realization and a remembrance that these things are important. I mean, I will go political for it. I mean, Nikki Haley, who, you know, has just put this thing out saying, why are we giving money to the humanities, to the NEA, and so forth like that? That money could be used for other purposes. And that's a very short-sighted element of it is the arts that are helping people get through this time right now.
And it's really a 21st century version of Mickey and Judy saying, hey, kids, let's put on the show. What if we just went to the barn and you made the costumes and I'll come up with the songs, you know?
That's exactly what it is. And so in that regard, companies are having to be very facile. They're having to figure out how they can make this work. And, you know, from our point of view, we're also cautiously optimistic. We know that this will pass. We know that we will come to a point, hopefully sooner than later, that people will be able to join each other. And I do think that what's going to be interesting is when we get to that point, I think there's going to be a major explosion of people wanting to get out and share time with other people.
Of course.
And when they're able to do that at a live performance, it's going to really underline how special that sharing of that experience truly is. So we're all holding our breath. We're all doing what we can to pull back budgets, to look at, you know, financially how we can get through. But at the end, I think we're going to all make it through somehow.
Well, you've got three different types of companies, the Gainesville Orchestra, the Opera North, and York Theater Company. They all face unique challenges, and they reflect the challenges that all those same types of institutions are dealing with. The York Theater Company in New York City is a great space. I've been going there long before you joined them. Mm-hmm. They have produced shows that have gone off Broadway. They mount productions that you'd never see in any other way. They showcase great talent. They revive shows that haven't been seen in years. It's just one of those institutions in New York that provides work, creates great stuff, and it's just a vibrant part of the community. And it was cool when you joined them. So how's it going at York? Obviously, they've had to cancel shows.
At the York, what we are doing right now is we were actually relatively lucky in that our last show, the new edition of Forbidden Broadway, mm-hmm. Had closed before we got into this period of time. Right now, we do have and this is our 50th anniversary, so we've been celebrating with a lot of special events. As a matter of fact, the last thing that happened was just before. We had an amazing evening with Sheldon Harnick celebrating his material, his songs, hosting the evening, which was not only him singing, but also Karen Ziemba, Liz Calloway, and Rebecca Luker, who came, you know, who has also been facing her own challenges recently. Diagnosed publicly, it is no secret, with ALS, and she came and performed, and it was an amazing evening.
And for those who don't know, Sheldon Harnick is one of the great theater lyricists and composers. He worked on Fiorello and She Loves Me, and of course Fiddler on the Roof, which is enough for anybody's tombstone right there.
Exactly. So we have, but that was the last thing we were able to do, and that was the Tuesday before. Everything kind of hit. So right now we are planning our 50th anniversary gala, which will be happening, we believe, now in the beginning of June. It was originally scheduled for May, but obviously we're pushing it a little bit, but we are planning on still doing it. We're planning on a main stage show that will happen after that, which is a new Irving Berlin show directed and choreographed by Randy Skinner, the amazing Randy Skinner of 42nd Street fame. And it is Irving Berlin and is Cheek to Cheek, Irving Berlin in Hollywood. And that will be our next main stage show that we are planning that will happen in the, perhaps in June.
You must be hearing from a lot of other companies that are worried about just being able to pay their rent next month. Well, it sounds like you guys are in a really good shape. If you're not even, I thought your first comment might be, well, we've spoken to our sponsors and the people, and they're providing the support we need. Obviously, money's tight, but if you're not actually worried about shutting down, that's good news.
We're always worried about that. Yeah. The one thing that has happened that is. As with other companies, you know, we are in the Citicorp building on 54th and Lexington, and that building has been shut down. So we are not able to even be in our offices right now. So like many other people, we're having our meetings via Zoom and daily staff meetings via that way. But because we're not able to be in the building, then that has helped us in terms of, obviously, we're not paying rent to a building that we don't that we can't be in. So we are managing what we can do. We are reaching out to our sponsors and to our donors. We're also selling our tickets where you can buy your tickets now and choose your dates later, which is one way that we're trying to find our way around this. We're also going to be doing an online auction of interesting and fun things that you could do even while you're in quarantine, including, you know, a Skype dance lesson with someone like Randy Skinner or Jerry McIntyre, that you can buy experiences where our development director Shayna Farr, who's also a wonderful cabaret artist, and myself will come into your apartment either live or via Skype and do a cabaret evening for you. So we're all finding ways of being creative to show people that, you know, that we are not going away. We are important. We are part of the fabric of your lives. And we want to be, continue to be, and we don't want you to forget that we are there too, even under this circumstances, to make things happen.
Well, and you know, it would seem that not only are you going through trouble, this is happening all over the world, whether it's the West End in London, but you know, the black boxes in London and Paris,
absolutely,
they're closed down, and Broadway is closed. So let me ask you this, as well, hypothetically, let's say you had tickets for, I don't know, May 9th for the new production of West Side Story and Six. And I'm asking for a friend here, but what would happen?
Well, I mean, I certainly hope that, I cannot speak for our commercial producer friends. But what I can say is that I'm sure they're going to honor those tickets. I'm sure, you know, there are certain, and if a show closes, then you will get your refund. If a show continues, then I'm sure they will reschedule you. So that is, you know, and again, what we are offering for people who have tickets to things that, you know, where we might have to delay is we're offering, you know, a rescheduling of those tickets or offering, since we are a not-for-profit and, you know, want to be able to continue our work, hopefully, if you cannot come at a later date, but perhaps you will donate your tickets to the cause.
And are you speaking to other people and other companies who are saying, we're going to have to shut down, we're not going to make it?
That is certainly a reality right now. There are some companies that are going to be facing those times. And the biggest issue that I think, you know, we all have to do, and I don't care whether you're a large company, a small company, an opera company, an orchestra, whatever, is to try to make the case that you are part of the community that you are, that you live in, that when you disappear, if you disappear, that community is going to be worse off, not just because of the aesthetic or the, you know,
but the commercial impact,
the commercial aspect of that, the money that you bring in terms of restaurants, in terms of people who come and stay in hotels, all of those other sides ramifications are very real. Those are not made up figures.
And that's a big impact for Opera North in New Hampshire. They are a real magnet. People come from all over. They spend their vacation there. They stay in hotels.
We average at Opera North, we average around 46, 47 states every year and 5 foreign countries.
People coming to there from all those states. Wow.
That's right. Coming to see Opera North. And this summer, I mean, we are fortunate in that we have a little bit of time on our side. We do not start up until July. So for right now, we are very much planning that our season will go forth. What we are looking at, though, is how we may have to look at our budget and tighten some things up, because we don't know, you know, in terms of support from sponsors or donor support, whether that will be able to continue to the level that we have expected.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're trying to do is tighten the time of our festival, which normally goes from the beginning of July to mid-August. This year, we're looking at moving it to a month-long period. And within that month, we'll still do our three productions along with our concerts and things. But we'll tighten the festival timeline and also look at how we can tighten the budget a little bit, just in case we don't have as many people coming. But we are definitely planning on moving forward. There's no question about that.
You're talking about Opera North, which obviously requires music. And I know that orchestras themselves have been for years facing cutbacks. And when they're not facing cutbacks, they're facing cutbacks on those cutbacks. So what is this like for symphonies, for orchestras, for the orchestra that you're working with,
right,
for Opera North?
Well, I mean, again, at this point with Opera North, everything in terms of our budget, we are planning on everyone getting paid what we have agreed, and we're not pulling back on that. What we are doing in Gainesville with the Gainesville Orchestra, our Pops concert, which was scheduled in May, we have rescheduled for the mid to the end of June at this point, which we fully expect to do. But what we have tried to do is offer orchestra members who, because they have been affected, you know, orchestra members even more so than a lot of other companies, they tend to go from one orchestra to another orchestra. And when you have a whole series of concerts canceled, they are really suffering. Mm-hmm. So what we offered was to the our orchestra members were we would pay them now for the June concert, with the understanding, of course, we'll still be doing the June concert, the Pops concert, to help give them a little bit of cash now to try to get them to that point where hopefully a lot of the summer jobs, the summer theater festivals, things like that will be picking up as well.
Looking across the whole country, in general, do you see symphonies, orchestras, the same thing? Obviously, those regional orchestras that bring so much joy to people, are they in generally good shape? I feel like for years, it's been a real tough haul for them, and that there seem to be fewer and fewer of them being able to exist and be able to provide the music that they do.
Yes, look, we know that the art and all of the arts companies are, it's never going to get easier. But that being said, I don't think you ever, you know, this is the one thing, there was a big mass meeting of Opera America on the phone the other day. And I said, look, and I made the point, because I said, look, we can sit here and complain about, you know, how tough it is and all that. But I mean, I'd rather spend the time, how do we keep moving forward? Because mm-hmm. that is the trick of it. And this is something I so strongly believe, that if you provide something, our audiences will come. They will respond. If you show that you are an engaged part of the community, that you're not just there to put on shows, you're not just there to you know, play an instrument, you're there as part of the cultural life and fabric of that community. And in that regard, I think that those companies that have been doing that are going to be okay. Other companies who perhaps just sat on their laurels or just expected people just to come and show up are not going to be okay. And that has always been the case. So I think that, you know, again, with our orchestra, we have great support locally. With Opera North, I think we have strived to not only do our shows, but we, you know, at Opera North, you know, we have created a new national park for the arts with the National Park Service at Blow Me Down Farm. This is a place that did not exist. I mean, the park did, but the festival did not. And we partnered with them because they took what was part of the area where Augustus St. Gaudens, the great American sculptor, the person who helped bring Charles Beeman, who helped bring him to the area, and created had his farm there. Opera North has gone in partnership with the Park Service to create a park for the arts. And that's something that we're very excited about. It has been a huge boom for the community, and we are in our third season and really starting to produce things there.
And you're performing, obviously, under the stars, things like that.
We're actually performing in a very big, very real circus tent. And part of what we did was we created a circus mashup with members of Big Apple Circus and Cirque du Soleil. This will be our third year of a production, our opening production, which has now become kind of a tradition, where we bring circus artists, our singers, our orchestra all together under the big tent and do a production with a theme, but all with live music, live artists, etc. And it has been a great thing, and people can come and picnic on the lawn. We have food vendors, and then they come into the circus tent and see this wonderful performance on the Connecticut River, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful, great way of having people come and not being afraid of, you know, seeing opera. And then we also will be doing our production of Magic Flute under the tent, and then our production of Rigoletto will be at the Opera House. Although, in the instance of seeing what we can do budget-wise, we might actually bring Rigoletto out under the tent and do it there this year.
Well, I think people might also be a little bit more, less afraid of going into an outdoor venue than an indoor venue. There's, right. I think, hopefully by summer, nobody will be afraid of, you know, walking down the street now. People avoid me like it's like I haven't bathed in days. I wish that would happen when I'm on the road and, you know, cars would just get out of my way. That would be kind of nice here in Los Angeles.
I know.
But let me ask you this, going back to the York Theatre Company, you've asked people to maybe donate their tickets or to take a nonprofit donation. They have done that here at the Geffen Playhouse in Los Angeles and the Kirk Douglas Theatre. And you know what? The tickets were already paid for. So the two productions that were canceled, I just did that. I just said, okay, well, you know what? You already have the money.
Right.
I'll take the tax write-off. What is the response to that from the York? What has their response been?
Well, to be fair, we have not been in that position because we have not canceled anything yet.
Okay.
Our spring production has been moved at this point, but we have not canceled anything yet, and hopefully we will not be canceling.
Yeah. Well, in London, of course, they canceled West End. Finally, Boris Johnson and the Conservatives dragged their feet in embracing social distancing and discouraging our gatherings. A lot of shows in the West End couldn't afford to shut down until they were ordered to do so for legal and financial reasons. So finally, they did that a week after Broadway did. I'm not sure if this dissent in New York was whether they waited too long on Broadway. Well, thank God that they did. But we know we're going to miss Broadway shows that will never happen. But when all this stuff goes on, there are big producers who are going to lose money on shows they were about to open, like The Hangman came from the UK or a revival of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Right.
And they will lose money, unfortunately. And we won't get the chance to see those shows. But the people who really suffer are the actors, the dancers, and the singers. There's no cabaret. There's no Broadway or off-Broadway. And, of course, when they're out of work, which they're used to, they then turn to waitering and catering, which, of course, that isn't happening at all either.
Well, the other challenge right now, besides the producers, the big name commercial producers, and this is where it can affect many of the theater companies, is a lot of the people who have money in those shows who have now lost those investments are a lot of people who also help make contributions to not-for-profit theaters all as well, and do it often out of the money that they're making off of their dividends from Moulin Rouge.
So it's a double hit.
It is a double hit, because then they are not, now they have lost the money they invested. But so they're not going to be putting money in to help these other. So the point of all of this is, look, we got to keep moving forward. We have to know and believe that people are responding, because we see that they are, to online things at the moment. And at the end of the day, we have to find ways of re-engaging and keeping engaged our audience people. And hopefully they begin to understand what is being brought to the table by all of these wonderful artists.
So you're saying the show must go on?
I do believe that, yes. This is one of the things that in talking about this summer, it's not a matter of just canceling. As far as I'm concerned, that is not on my radar screen. We must find a way of making these things continue to happen in various ways, as every company will have to grapple with and figure out. But as far as I'm concerned, that's not even a discussion to have.
Well, I can think of no better way to wrap up our time here with you than on that note.
Singing a song. Are we going to sing a song? There's no business. Come on, everybody.
You first.
Please, I won't stop. It's been very encouraging hearing you talking about the things that you're planning and doing, rather than going, oh my God, how are we going to get through the next week? So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us, Evans. And we look forward to having you back on the show when things are up and running again. You can tell us about the great stuff that's happening rather than the stuff that will happen.
Well, I'm honored and so happy to be on this. And thank you guys so much for taking the time and creating this wonderful show so that people do stay engaged.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, that was great of Evans to join us. I've known him for years. I have to say I'm jealous because he has a great apartment on the Upper West Side, like in the 70s. I love it. I would kill him just to get that apartment. But don't tell Evans that.
Well, I think you just did, by the way.
Oh,
just
whoops,
FYI.
Whoops,
yeah.
Whoops.
It's being recorded. That's kind of the way this works.
Like Rope, the Hitchcock thing. If they were trying to get an apartment, that movie would have been perfect.
Well, I wonder if Evans has lived in that apartment for like 50 years, because you had to like be born into it, because that's kind of the way those apartments work.
Well, he lived in Gainesville, Florida. I don't know when he bought that place, but it was, of course, many years ago. I'm sure it was a smart move and a great place. I love it. First time I went, I was like, ooh. oh, I want this apartment. oh, apartment jealousy. It's a big New York thing. But he's earned the right to have it. So it's no big deal that he has a great apartment in New York. I'm just a little jealous.
Oh, I see what you're doing there. You're moving us along to Big Deal or Big Whoop. Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines and entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. This next story actually is making headlines front page of the New York Times. It made a couple of tech podcasts that I listened to.
Interesting.
Because the Internet Archive, okay, they actually have a project called the Internet Library. It's a project to digitize books, especially, they say, those available only in print editions. During the pandemic, they announced a national emergency library. When people can't get to the library and waiting lists for ebooks don't make sense, the National Emergency Library would make its 1.4 million digital copies available to as many people as wanted. Initial coverage was positive, saying that the library contained public domain titles like Charles Dickens, Jane Austen, and big classic authors. Not so fast, said publishers and the Authors Guild, who are outraged at the action. They say it's an attack on copyright and that many of the books involved are not in the public domain, but books under copyright for which authors depend on their livelihood. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal for several reasons. I would compare it to when we had Andrew Wallenstein on the show and he was saying, hey, this is a great time to where maybe studios can work with exhibitors and fix the problem with windowing and change the system that they've been trying to change for decades, to which exhibitors say, hey, you know what? Taking advantage of us at this particular time of crisis, not the best time to negotiate and get us to cave to something we have been fighting for decades. So that's a very touchy issue. And here you have somewhat of the same thing. You feel like publishers and authors are saying, hey, you're attacking copyright now? Really? You want to use the virus to attack copyright? No fair. So the Internet Library is a great thing, and they do something I really like a lot, which publishers and authors hate. It's called controlled digital lending. And their idea was, hey, look, libraries have books on the shelf that are they're out of print, they're old, they were never made into ebooks, or they're not appropriate as an ebook because they have a lot of visuals, and they don't exist as an ebook, which limits the people who can borrow it, not because of the number of copies, but just there are people who can't always get to the library, et cetera, or they're in different locations. So they said, here's what we'll do. We'll make you a PDF, a digital version of that book, just basically a visual page by page rendition of the book. It's not nearly as flexible or easy to read on a phone as a traditional ebook. It's not like that, but it is something you can look at. It's like if you're a researcher or someone. So we've got that digital version. And if somebody wants to take out that book, who has the right to take out that book, the library goes and grabs the physical copy, takes it off the shelf so no one else can use it, and makes it unavailable. Then they send the PDF to that person because they can't get the print copy for some reason, or they just prefer it this way. They look at that, and when it's returned, they take the physical copy and put it back on the shelf. So they're saying, look, they have bought one copy. They're only making it available to one library patron at a time. They're just, instead of handing them the physical book for various reasons, they're going to hand them this PDF. That's what they're doing. I think it's fair use, but it still has to go through the courts. The publishers and the authors hate it and say it's terrible and wrong. So in that context, they already don't like the Internet Library, but I do support what they do, including this. They should digitize everything, and I think this one book per purchase, per loan, is a perfectly fair thing to do. It makes sense. Why publishers would fight it, I have no idea, because I don't think it hurts them in any way, shape, or form. But what they did here was to say, well, we've been making copies of all these books. And they got a lot of mostly books apparently from the 20th century, not mostly Dickens and the like. And they've digitized them in this way. It's not as useful, but they're there. And they say, oh, let's make them available to everyone. And you know what? Everybody can have as many copies as they want. So if they've got one digital copy of Stephen King's new novel, they can loan it out a gazillion times. What do they care? It's an emergency. They're saying, well, libraries are closed. We're just trying to help. And the publisher is saying, no, you can't do that. So in this case, why did they decide they get to just ignore copyright? Why did they decide they can just do something they know is probably against the law? It's ridiculous. It hurts the cause that they are already doing a good job on. I think it was a stupid thing for them to do. They're not really helping anyone. If they had an idea that more copies should be made available as ebooks and there should be an amnesty, they should have suggested that to libraries and publishers. That's the proper way to do it. So they've hurt themselves. They've hurt the good work they're doing. And in this case, I do support the publishers and the authors, but I do think their initial program and thing they've been doing long term is great.
Well, a couple things here. You know, right now, what the Internet Archive and the Internet Library does, they were trying to say, look, there's a lot of students out there. They need some of these books. They can't get them. So let's try and make some of those books available. Putting that aside for a moment, what the Internet Archive is trying to do is take a lot of what are called orphaned works and make sure that they're saved. And they used an example. Actually, it wasn't them. It was one of the members of the Authors Guild used this as an example. They cited a 1925 book on like Bolshevik folk tales,
right,
which the publisher is still around. The book is way out of print. You can't buy it. You can't, you know, most libraries don't even own it.
Right. And interlibrary loaning of that physical copy is laborious, expensive, and difficult to do.
And it's from 1925. So it's 1 year before it hits you know, the public domain. And they're like, first of all, the author is never, it's long, nobody can even find the author or the author's estate, okay? So let's put that aside as well. So it's pretty much an orphaned work. The publisher's not going to make any money from sales since they can't sell it. This is a work that... Right.
This is good work that they do. There are a gazillion books that fall through the cracks when you go to a new format. There are tons of albums that are now on YouTube, music and recordings that are not available on CD or available digitally. You can't go to any streaming service and legally get them. You can't buy them anywhere. They're just orphan works, like you say. They're old radio shows that have disappeared that you can find online that people have probably just posted on their own initiative. And I'd love for them all to be available commercially and people get paid, but they are orphan works. That's the great work that they do. There's tons of other examples, but that has nothing to do with what they did this week when they just tried to open up the doors. And they've got lots of books. It's not just 1925 folk tales. They've got books from the 70s, 80s, and 90s that are not orphaned works. They've made no attempt to distinguish between public domain or orphan books and just generally available commercial fiction when they've thrown open the doors and said, you want a million people want to borrow this book? Great, go right ahead. So they're doing great work, like you say, but this is not an example of that.
Yeah, I think that they would have been, much like you cited Andrew Wallenstein and what he was referring to in terms of windows and how this might be an opportunity to fix those theatrical windows, or at least kind of negotiate on them. This would have been an interesting way to negotiate on orphaned works, where the publisher might still be around in some shape or form, probably consumed by several other publishers. But the author is no longer alive. Their estate probably is no longer functioning. The book is no longer in print.
Well, they're challenging them in court. This is going through the court system. That's where it's going to be resolved. They have been speaking to them. And the time of the coronavirus, publishers are saying, we've got other things to worry about, like our business collapsing. So no, this actually isn't a great time for us to discuss this arcane issue that we're already fighting you in court on. This will be decided by the courts. It's not, this week is not the time to tackle that issue.
Well, the courts are closed.
That's true. Exactly. But the Library of Congress is still working.
Yeah. In fact, they announced 25 new recordings to their registry for historic, cultural, or aesthetic importance.
Right, that's audio recordings that are placed, yes, as a special hall of fame.
Right. In other words, you know, they may not be good, but they are significant, like all of our recordings.
Yes.
Hence, by the way, the inclusion of one of my favorite songs, Hello Mudda, Hello Fada, by Alan Sherman. And the LP Mr. Rogers Sings 21 Favorite Songs from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. I like that album just because it has way too many words in its title.
Hello, neighbor.
Also on the list, by the way, Paul Whiteman's Whispering, Maria Callas' singing Puccini, and Eddie Arnold's Make the World Go Away, which, by the way, actually turned to, it happened.
It may be happening, yes, so, yes.
Yeah. In non-music categories, you can find the WGBH broadcast of the Boston Symphony, the day President Kennedy was assassinated, the radio episode The Bathysphere from the series Lights Out, and the most famous call in all of baseball, the October 3rd, 1951 moment when broadcaster Russ Hodges said, "The Giants win the pennant! The Giants win the pennant!" I think he said it like four times.
Four times.
Yeah. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
That's a big whoop, of course. I think that I should have said that's the most famous call in all of sports. Forget baseball. That's probably the single most iconic sports call of all time. It's a great one. It's a big whoop, of course, in the scheme of things, but it's fun to see. And you know what? Do like what my mom and I did. I said, we've got time on our hands. I said, let's listen to every single thing on the Library of Congress recording. We didn't listen to the all of Tosca, but we did listen to an aria by Maria Callas from that 1953 recording. And we did listen to Hello Mudda, Hello Fada. And that's, you know, that is a clever, funny song, but it's also such a time capsule because it's about a kid riding home from summer camp. First of all, kids don't go to summer camp as much anymore. That used to be a big rite of passage. Nowadays, they're too busy working on their college resumes to spend a summer, you know, playing in the woods. And secondly, they don't write letters, you know, so it really is a time capsule of a particular era in American history. And it is funny, like you say. I think Mr. Rogers, that album is just sort of riding the Mr. Rogers bandwagon. But most everything else makes good sense to me, like the songs YMCA, Whitney Houston's cover of I Will Always Love You, Wichita Lineman by Glen Campbell. There are also albums. I will admit, I did not play a song from The Chronic by Dr. Dre for my mother. You know why? Because it ain't on Spotify or Apple. I think it's only on Tidal or something. I don't know where it is, but that album is not available on Spotify. But Private Dancer by Tina Turner, that's there. Cheap Trick at Budokan, the Fiddler on the Roof cast album, and so on and so forth. Lots of good stuff. And I highly recommend the radio play, The Bathysphere, from the series Lights Out. You know, that's the show where they said, if you're scared and easily scared, do not listen to this broadcast. You know, you'll hurt your heart. It's fun and very political, very timely indeed. I know exactly why the people at the Library of Congress put that episode in their Hall of Fame right now. And if you listen to it, you'll note the same reason.
Okay, pop quiz.
Mm-hmm.
Who said, and for what reason, the following?
Second base. I'm sorry.
In a year that has been so improbable, the impossible has happened.
It sounds like Yogi Berra, but I don't know.
It was Vin Scully after Kirk Gibson's home run in 1988 in the 1988 World Series.
See, that sounds too planned. That sounds like something he had in his back pocket to spit out, you know?
Well, but that was Vin Scully. He always had, like, you're always like, how did he do that? And
right.
He just, you know, that he, like, as a matter of fact, I actually once saw Vin Scully, who's still alive, by the way. I saw him at the grocery store. And
I hope he was 6 feet away.
Well, this was many,
I'm
many
kidding,
years ago.
Kidding.
And he said, and the reason I knew it was him is I first heard him. And he said, I came all the way to the grocery store for these cookies, and wouldn't you know it, they're all out. And I thought,
that's got to be Vin Scully.
I was like, what the? Wait, they're also out of they're out of peaches. Come over to the produce section. Do that over here too. Like, I was like, this is amazing. What else are they out of?
Well, Vin Scully turned 92. We hope he has many years ahead of him. But one artist who did not make it to 93 is the French comic book artist Albert Uderzo. He's one of the co-creators of Asterix and Obelix. And if you're not familiar with it, you should be familiar with this intro. The year is 50 BC. Gaul is entirely occupied by the Romans. Well, not entirely. That is how every edition of Asterix and Obelix began. It was created by Uderzo along with his co-creator, where is his name? René Goscinny. It's a series, about 34 books they did together, or him on his own. Asterix is a not-so-tall warrior living in Gaul back when the Roman Empire occupied it. His best pal is the super-strong Obelix, and they had hilarious adventures that played off current events, even though it was set back in ancient times. They created 34 comic books together, and then Albert on his own. 370 million copies of those comic books have been sold around the world.
Kind of like the number of people that listen to the show.
Exactly.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. More than each person bought one comic book, and now that's why. More than a dozen live-action animated films have been spun off. Endless merchandising. There's even an Asterix theme park. Now, he retired in 2009, and he sold the rights to the series to Hachette. When a new team created five more comic books, that's part of that 370 million copy legacy that we have. But we reported on that back in 2009, Sperling. Good Lord.
And after this month, that seems like about 150 years ago.
Yeah. He may have died, but Showbiz Sandbox will go on forever.
Well, also passing away or dying, it was Polish composer Krzysztof Penderecki. He died at the age of 86. And you might actually know Penderecki's music but not know Penderecki because his music was in everything from The Exorcist to The Shining to Children of Men. David Lynch often used his work, and Johnny Greenwood of Radiohead has always cited Penderecki as a major influence on Radiohead's work.
And
certainly his own film work.
Yeah, and they even collaborated together on some public performances. He died at 86. Some of his major works include his breakthrough, Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima, and then Polymorphia and St. Luke Passion. Those are ones well worth checking out.
Now, you know, Tony-winning playwright Terrence McNally, he survived the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s, and then he survived lung cancer, but coronavirus, he did not survive. He died at the age of 81 due to complications of coronavirus. He's a five-time Tony winner with both plays and musicals.
That's very rare.
Yeah, I mean, usually it's just plays or just musicals. And Masterclass, remember Zoe Caldwell? We talked about her a couple of weeks ago. She actually played Maria Callas in Masterclass. She died a couple of weeks ago, and now Terrence McNally, the playwright, has died as well.
Well, good callback to the Library of Congress recording, putting Maria Callas's 1953 Tosca, that entire opera, into the canon. Yes, he also did Love, Valor, Compassion, Ragtime, among other shows. I love this story. And of course, his breakthrough was Frankie and Johnny in the Clair de Lune. But when he was 21, a young gay man in New York, a little innocent perhaps, he was at a party and playwright Edward Albee invited him back to his apartment for a nightcap. And McNally said, well, gosh, won't your wife or family get mad? And Albee was like,
Welcome to New York.
Welcome to New York, young man. They lived together for 4 years as lovers while Albee wrote his masterpiece, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? So that's pretty great. Also dying this week is cult film director Stuart Gordon. He died at 72. I think of him always as a horror director, but he really just made two important horror films. Those were back in the 80s, Reanimator and From Beyond. I'm not a horror guy, but Reanimator is great fun. It's got a streak of dark humor. It's considered a classic, and it's spun off a stage musical and all sorts of extra stuff. But he also did the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids franchise. Somehow he got his name attached to that, which surely must be the best payday he had in his entire career. In fact, they're just starting a TV series, or at least they were, until production shut down. But here's something I did not know about him, Stuart Gordon. He launched a theater company that premiered works by David Mamet, among others, and he was quite active in the LA theater scene. Did you ever come across him?
You know, I am sure that if he did anything at the Geffen or the Music Center, I'm sure I saw him because I see all those shows. But not off the top of my head, I can't recall.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I also can't recall if I've ever seen the work of Ken Shimura. He also died at the age of 70 due to complications from coronavirus. He was kind of nicknamed the Japanese Robin Williams, or as in Japan, they know Robin Williams, the American Ken Shimura.
Exactly.
He was a comedian, and he joined the comedy troupe The Drifters, and he had a lifetime of variety shows and TV comedies and specials, very popular in Japan.
That's right. Also popular in the U.S. I didn't think he would be remembered quite this well, but country artist Joe Diffie, he died at 61, also from complications due to coronavirus. Very sad. But he's the pickup man, not as in pickup truck, but just, I mean, as in pickup truck, not as in pickup artist. He was a good old boy country artist, a neo-traditionalist. He had a string of top 10 hits in the 90s. He was a big influence on Jason Aldean, Chris Young, and others. So he's being remembered, sadly, 61. So his heyday was in the past, but his influence was still being felt. That's certainly the case for our last person in the obit section. This is African music superstar Manu Dibango, who died at the age of 86. He was a Cameroonian legend who combined traditional West African styles with jazz and funk, and he's a major innovator. If you think about the influence he's had over the decades, as an appreciation posted by BBC writer Rita Ray put it, whether it was Congolese rumba in the 50s, disco in the 70s, or hip-hop in the 90s, his contribution to the development of modern music cannot be overstated.
And those are some fighting words. Those are like, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, again, she's not saying modern African music. She's saying modern music. And when you think about rumba and disco and hip hop, those are worldwide phenomenons. You may not think of rumba, but that was a big, big genre for quite a long time. And it's still, of course, a style of music played to this day. So he was a big, important figure. Though in the U.S., he's probably best known for the 1972 hit Soul Makossa, written for the 72 African Cup of Nations Soccer Tournament. That was a big worldwide hit. Obviously, it didn't hit the U.S. charts, but it was a hit. And that song features a very, very catchy chant that goes, Mama say, mama sa, mama kusa. Mama say, mama sa, mama kusa. Mama say, mama, mama, mama. And you know what? Michael Jackson loved that little chant. In fact, he decided to use it. And he put it in Wanna Be Starting Something, the what do you call it? The outro of that song has that chant going on throughout the song. And I guess he didn't feel the need to credit Mata DiBongo. Maybe he didn't think anyone would notice, but it turned out to be the lead-off track on the best-selling original album of all time. And Manu noticed, and he sued, and Jackson settled out of court, essentially admitting, yeah, that's your thing. I shouldn't have taken that. And I have to tell you, it's a great album, of course. I love that song. It may be my favorite song on the album. It's such an unbelievably catchy song. One of the great, you know, opening tracks on an album of all time. But I bought it on cassette. You know, I was buying albums on cassette back then, not even CDs.
Oh, I love the fidelity of cassette. Exactly. You could hear every word.
Yeah, you know, but I just wanted to be able to play in the car and on my Walkman and in my stereo at home. So that's why I was a cassette guy. I wanted that portability. So that was super important to me, more than high fidelity. I wanted to be able to listen to music while driving and anywhere else. So that's why I listened to cassettes in the early days. As soon as CDs came out, I switched to them. But that meant you didn't have lyrics for most albums. Sometimes they would have complex lyrics, but I didn't have lyrics for Thriller. I just had the cassette. I'm listening to the album. And like, as so often happens, you don't know what they're saying sometimes. At the end of the song, you know, want to be starting something. You know, and at the end of the song, it's going, mama say, mama say, mama kusa, mama say. And all I could hear was, I was saved by the sound of Michael's song. I was saved by the sound of Michael's song. I was saved by the sound of Michael's song. Which sounds like a messianic call to, I will save you with my music. And he did save the world for a while. Heal the world, save the world. I love those lyrics. I think they work better. If he'd used my lyrics, he wouldn't have been sued. And he would have saved a lot of money. And I could have gotten a co-songwriting credit. So the next time you listen to Wanna Be Starting Something, instead of, you know, to Mata DiBongo, of course, you should remember it's his thing, mama say, mama sa, mama kusa. But try my lyrics too. I was saved by the sound of Michael's song.
Well, next week, Michael will be rewriting other Michael Jackson songs, and maybe we'll throw in a few other artists for him to kind of, you know, just, you know, like a word jumble.
Spruce up.
Yeah. But in the meantime, you don't want to miss that show, next week's show. Subscribe to us on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher,
rate us,
anywhere.
Rate us.
Yes, please rate us, review us. It does help us out.
What are you doing? Rate us. Come on.
Well, links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as links to Evans Hale's website and work. By the way, thank you, Evans, for joining us. All that information can be found on showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us, as well as ways to email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're also on Twitter. We're @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's theresnobusinesslikeshowbusiness.org.
.org. You're going to have to pay extra for that, by the way.
Okay.
And by the way, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.